Support for this episode of Judaism Unbound comes from the Ashman Family JCC in Palo Alto, California, whose vision is to be the architects of the Jewish future. The Ashman Family JCC is an incubator for new expressions of Jewish identity. It creates innovative Jewish learning, celebrations, and arts programs that inspire personal connections to people and ideas from across the Jewish world. Learn more at www.paloaltojcc.org. This is Judaism Unbound, episode 162, 100% Black, 100% Jewish. Welcome back, everyone. I'm Dan Liebenson.
And I'm Lex Rofberg.
And our guest this week goes by the name of Manishtana, which, as you might know, in the Passover Seder means, why is this, in that case, night different from all other nights? And in this case, Manishtana is asking, what's different about this Jew from many other Jews? Manishtana is a New York-based African-American Orthodox Jew. His parents were also African-American Orthodox Jews, and he is an author, writer, educator, playwright, rabbi, and public speaker, primarily concerned with racial and religious identity and culture and how that intersection manifests in America. He is currently studying for his second Orthodox rabbinical ordination. He grew up in Chabad and hails from a legacy of African-American Judaism stretching back to the 1780s. Manishtana's writing has appeared in a wide variety of magazines. He speaks widely across the country, including a very wonderful Eli talk, which you can link to from our show notes. And his most recent piece of writing is a novel called Ariel Samson, Freelance Rabbi, which came out just a few months ago. Before we jump into the conversation, just a quick word. There are a few audio hiccups here and there. Nothing to be concerned about. We know you can just listen right through them and they shouldn't bother you too much, but we just wanted to let you know that we apologize that some of the audio is not up to our usual standards, but we're excited to jump into it. We're excited for you to hear from Manishtana. And so, Manishtana, welcome to Judaism Unbound. It's so great to have you.
Hey, it's great to be here.
Well, I wanted to start off actually with your name, Manishtana, because I think that you're our first guest operating under a nom de plume. And I think it'd be really interesting to hear from you why you are doing so and what the meaning of your adopted name is and anything else you want to say about that.
Well, one, I'm a large fan of superheroes. I played maybe a little bit of part of having an alter ego. So 10 years ago, I started doing this writing and work, you know, in classic superhero form to like protect friends and family for like backlash of, you know, the random things people would say. You know, it happens a lot. People just walk up to me on the street who are strangers and they know who I am. I have no idea who they are. But to cut down on any like secondary waves of backlash, like, you know, friends or family, I chose a nom de guerre. I chose Manishtana specifically as a play on, you know, Manishtana Halayla Hazeh, the Seder question that asks what makes this night so different from any other night. What I try to ask is the question, what makes this Jew so different from any other Jew? So Manishtana was born.
I wanted to jump in to your most recent book. I mean, you've written multiple books, but your most recent book is something I read cover to cover in a very short period of time. I was very deeply absorbed very quickly. And it's called Ariel Samson, Freelance Rabbi. And I wanted to dive in because in so many ways, I think it's actually a must read for folks who listen to this podcast, but also to just in general, people that are wandering their way through American Jewish life in one form or another. And so I wanted to open up to you sort of what led you to write this most recent book of yours. It's a novel. It's got a very particular style. I mean, you're informal, but simultaneously very cutting and deep. You break the fourth wall sometimes and like shout out to the readers. I was curious, what led you to write this book and why did it take the form that it did?
That is a very interesting question to ask immediately after why I'm Manishtana, because it's a weird case of life creating art, creating life. What I really set out or wanted to do in life was be a screenwriter, like a director. I wanted to like do things about elves and dragons and whatnot, maybe a few gangster movies. And as I was going about writing these screenplays, I realized, well, you know, there's not a lot of, you know, Orthodox Jewish screenwriters out there, and not a lot of Black Jewish screenwriters out there. If I'm doing this, I might as well, you know, write at least one thing about that experience. And so I started writing this screenplay. And at the end of writing the screenplay, I had a 278-page screenplay. And I said, no one's going to sit here for like 4 hours to watch this thing. There were so many things I wanted to touch on in the screenplay, but I only had glancing landings on each topic. So it wasn't really even giving the topics I wanted to cover enough space to be more than just like a blink. So that's when I started blogging and writing to sort of introduce those topics into like the common parlance, into, you know, social consciousness. And so the blogging turned into speaking gigs and turned into writing books and turned into what led me to become Manish Tanai in the first place. It's sort of been like hanging in the back of my head. I tried to convert it to maybe this could be a web series. And I just ended up taking the screenplay and converting it into a novel.
We've mentioned on the show before, but our podcast actually came to be when we were trying to write a book and didn't feel like we had enough material for the book. So we wanted to like research out loud via talking to people on a podcast. So it's sort of like maybe an inverse kind of thing to what you're talking about. If you're out there listening and you want to create like a movie, clearly you got to try to write a book first, something like that. And then it'll turn into it.
Take up knitting and then you'll
yes, that's,
you'll be a director.
That's the real secret. Yeah. But so I'd love to really dive into like the story of this book and the main character. And I guess to start off, I'm curious to some extent, so you mentioned right at the top of the book that like in some senses there's autobiographical elements of this book, but it's not like you. It's not like directly you're the main character, but the main character is a Black Orthodox rabbi, which also describes you. And so I was curious just to really dive in to that character, Ariel Sampson, and hear how he came to be, and to the extent you'd like to sort of draw up the world in which he inhabits that sort of plays out in your book, that'd be great.
It's sort of weird that everyone immediately assumes that I'm, you know, the main character, particularly since when I wrote it, I was not a rabbi. I had no intention of like doing any of the things that Ariel ends up doing that I eventually ended up doing years later after I rewrote him doing it. So it's a weird entanglement there. So Ariel was a very difficult character to write because situations that he finds himself in, you know, little microaggressions or just aggressions, macroaggressions, are all actual things that have happened to me. But how he reacts to them is very different. And so that's slightly difficult to write because I'm more of a jaded, cynical person. I'm a lot more like the character of Alice that's in the book, who's also Black and Jewish. And just like a mansion darling from Roseanne mixed with a little bit of Daria and also Black. And that's Alice. So that's the character I like to hang out in her skin the most. The kind of dialogue that I wanted to happen and the kind of reactions that, you know, most Jews of color have in those scenarios that I think it's important for other people to see and experience, be able to digest and read, I generally don't have. But it's important to see that this is, you know, what you do to people when you say this thing or how they feel when they're in this situation, regardless of how well-meaning you think you might be at the moment.
I wanted to ask just for maybe if we could do without too much spoilers, one or two specific examples of the microaggressions you're talking about. And I'm thinking of one that stuck with me involving Ariel Sampson's character at a Shabbat dinner table with a variety of different kinds of people. It's sort of an interesting crowd at this Shabbat dinner table, but there's a couple particularly aggressive folks who are badgering him about Ethiopia and Ethiopian Jews. And I was curious if that might be one particular example we could look at as what you mean by sort of the microaggressions that happen that you take differently than how the main character does.
Yes, that was definitely an example of, well, one, that was a scene I absolutely had to nail. It happens literally all the time. Right. But that's a example where I had to give him different reactions because that conversation would not have lasted nearly as long with me. So it starts with like the general question of that always happens, like, what's your background? Actually, in the beginning of that exchange, he does give a lot slightly more sarcastic answers than his character would have before, because he's just starting to move into that sort of space. But he answers with, you know, his educational background, because that's one of our sort of coping mechanisms as Jews of color when we meet these sort of microaggression questions, is to at least try to have as much fun in the experience as we possibly can. And so actually, this is something that I learned from my wife. She was very fond of saying, answer the question that they're asking, not the one you know they're asking. He knows the question is, what's your racial ethnic background? How are you Black and Jewish at this table? What they asked was, what's your background? So why should he think the first thing is race? Oh, and then there's also the sort of mini conversation around, well, Jews of color, what does that mean? That's not a thing. And the answers to that. And then simultaneously, there's always a pushback when Jews of color talk about their experiences and how they're discriminated against, of, well, people who are divorced, you know, have problems finding someone to match within the shidduch matchmaking system, or people who are converts, people who are different kinds of, you know, Hasidic or Haredi Jews. The answer to that is always, yes, that is true, but you're just using that to bring that up now in this conversation to sort of silence this one. These are things that you literally never sit around the table talking about. That's why they continue to happen. So you're just trying to have your cake and eat it too. And actually for me, it was really important. Like, I don't see this as necessarily a Jewish book or a Black book. It's chock full of both.
Totally.
There's, you know, like even some of the phrasing and lingo is like in the earlier chapters, first describing, you know, Ariel's circumcision, with the description of like the cookouts and, you know, the dark liquor and dominoes and specific Black cultural things that, you know, casual Jewish readers won't pick up, the same way that there are very cultural Jewish things that casual non-Jewish readers won't pick up.
I wonder whether there's a way in which Jews of color are sort of symbolizing or kind of like an advanced scouting group of all kinds of issues that all Jews are facing, but that it becomes more apparent for Jews of color. So let me give you just one example, right? I think the idea that you've been talking about in terms of Jews of color, African-American Jews inhabiting both a life as a Jew and also a life as a African-American in the United States. And so when you're pulled over by the police, you're not being pulled over because you're a Jew. You're being pulled over because you're Black. Whereas Jews are used to, you know, at least culturally, Jews are used to all the oppression that they suffer being because they're Jews. And so I guess I'm wondering whether as the American Jewish community in a larger way becomes more varied in terms of the ethnic backgrounds and all kinds of other backgrounds and identities of Jews where we live all the time. And most of us live in multiple identities and multiple worlds, which is a relatively new phenomenon in the Jewish experience, and perhaps not one where we've really developed a lot of mechanisms of knowing how to live that way, whether there's wisdom or at least warnings that kind of are relevant beyond the world of Jews of color, but that come from the experience of Jews of color.
So I would very definitely say that we benefit from not only being on the inside, but also being able to see you from the outside looking in. As people who, quote, don't look Jewish, we also see how the Jewish world interacts with the non-Jewish world. Mm-hmm. My grandmother back in, I guess, the 60s would say that there's going to be a second Holocaust and it's going to happen here in America. And that was over 50 years ago, having existed in the Jewish community and being able to see, as someone who's also African American, how Jews interacted with non-Jewish society and how non-Jewish society interacted with Jews. So for better or for worse, on both sides. And here we are in 2019, and I don't think I need to tell anyone that things are getting a little prickly here in the country when it comes to, among other
minority groups, Jews.
So, I mean, is that an example in terms of what your grandmother was saying? Is that an example of the wisdom of somebody who has lived in the United States as an African American for so long and sort of understands the nature of society in the United States in a certain deep way because of that experience, being able to let the Jews know that, you know, don't fool yourselves. Don't think that, you know, you're really as accepted as you might think it appears that you are.
Absolutely. And I mean, just by the different mechanisms that Jews of color and white Jews have come to even exist in this country.
As African Americans, at some point, some descendancy of slavery or being brought over or, you know, these laws here and these legal looking laws under this lattice work that each individual bar is fine, but you lace them together and you have a cage. Like, for example, the reason why the Holocaust was so successful in Europe is because Jews saw themselves as citizens. They saw themselves as Germans. We're German. Nothing's going to happen to us. For Jews of color, we don't have the privilege of that luxury of thinking we're considered citizens. It's just encoded in how we're here in the first place. We're obsolete farm equipment that people can't use, and that makes some people mad.
So the tagline on your website is 100% Black, 100% Jewish, 0% safe, which I love. But it also brings to my mind these questions, which I think I remember, Lex, we talked about early on in the podcast, that when I was a kid or when I was even in college, I feel like there were these questions sometimes, are you more Jewish or more American? You know, and the implication was that if you say you're more American, you're sort of proving that you're part of the assimilationists, you know, and that you're, by being substantially American or even more American or even being able to talk about it that way, you're proving everybody right who was afraid that the Jews coming to America was going to mean assimilation. But I feel that your tagline and also just the reality of race puts the lie to that question, right? Because as you say, you're 100% Black and 100% Jewish. And it's kind of like a Venn diagram in the sense that, of course, there's no contradiction between those, and there's an ability for them to completely overlap without sort of a sense of assimilation. And also that they constitute identities that also overlap with other people who don't have the other identity, and that sort of all of that can coexist, or at least we hope that it will be able to coexist at some point in the future when we figure all this out. And I guess I'm wondering, again, whether that reality, which people of color, particularly African Americans in the United States, experience, which is that I can't hide this even if I wanted to, and I don't want to, but even if I did, all right, this is apparent to everybody, is kind of, again, allowing Jews of color to scout out something that actually is of relevance to all Jews, which is that in the future, we're going to have to reimagine Judaism as something that lives along with our other identities and somehow contributes to them back and forth in a way that perhaps the myth of what Judaism was before suggested that wasn't what it was supposed to be about, that Judaism was supposed to be your number one identity and everything else was extremely secondary, if that. So I wonder on all of those levels whether there's, and whether you see significant learnings and significant ways to reorient the very meaning of Jewish identity that kind of flow out of the experience of Jews of color in America.
I don't think it's necessary for there to be a reorientation of the story of the origin of Jews, because it's always been comprehensive and inclusive. The problem is that those parts are either forgotten or conveniently not looked at or studied. Even when it comes to race in Judaism, like in the holiday of Purim that you celebrate every year, where we like dress up and, you know, we give out, it's like reverse trick or treat. We give gifts and food and things like that. But the Book of Esther talks about the Jews that lived in the communities from India to Ethiopia and how they were the ones that weren't wiped out. They didn't disappear when you close the last page of the Megillah. Hurricane Rabbi Eliezer talks about Noah's sons being blessed, Ham being blessed to be black and like the raven, Shem being blessed to be black and comely, Yafet to be blessed to be white and beautiful. If Shem is the ancestor of Abraham, then there's already a midrashic text source that says, yeah, they were black. Zipporah in the Book of Numbers described as an Ethiopian. And not to mention the mixed multitude that comes up from Egypt with the children of Israel, and they all become Jews at the same time. So it's, I don't think it's so much a need to reimagine Jewish origins as to be for people to actually read what's been there for at least a couple thousand years.
So I really appreciate that. And I also, after reading your book, started following you on Facebook. And
I'm sorry.
Right. Well, and you know, shout out, you were named one of the top 50 folks to follow on Twitter. I'm less of a Twitter user.
To those people too.
Right. But I'm less on Twitter, but I follow you on Facebook. And I wanted to hear from you about sort of a recent, it was a recent set of posts from you, but I think it's important for listeners to hear and to process and think about. And before I get to that, there was like a 1 or 2 week period. I forget exactly when these events were juxtaposed. Maybe it was over a longer period of time than that. But where there were two really marked, terrible instances of racism towards Jews of color that I saw and heard about on social media. One was that a man named Yehuda Webster, who's a Jewish educator, he was carrying a Torah. He was carrying a Sefer Torah, a Torah scroll, in Brooklyn to his car and driving somewhere. And a bunch of Jews in the area assumed that he was not Jewish, for obviously the only reason being that he is black. And they like took the Torah away from him. And it was this.
They didn't take it away. They mobbed him and they blocked his Uber from driving away. So they locked him in with cars and they like mobbed the car demanding like, who are you? Why are you carrying this? You have to answer us.
Yeah. And so I heard about that in very close proximity to a post that you put on Facebook about somebody who had been at a comedy show and experienced not an identical, but a similar targeting based on the fact that they are a Jew of color. And so I wanted to put those out there, A, for our listeners to really wrestle with, because it would be foolish of us to think that that couldn't happen in many of our communities. It's way too easy to be like, oh, that was in an Orthodox area of Brooklyn, or oh, that was like, no, this kind of stuff happens all the time, and it happens in all sorts of denominational contexts and geographical contexts. But also, I just want to hear from you what sort of call to action you would give to us in terms of how we should respond and how we need to do better going forward.
In the case of the first with Yehuda Webster, he very graciously, he's a colleague of mine, so we talked about this. He was very gracious about the entire scenario, way more than I would have been, and reached out for calls and dialogue and tolerance. And as of yet, nothing has really, you know, been reached back in his direction. The people who were involved have commented in other spaces as to why they felt it was right and et cetera, but no steps there have been made to reconcile or anything like that. In the second scenario, comedian Leah Forster, after those posts, she commented actually on the Facebook post and later herself made her own post apologizing and vowing to better. And it's like a 50-50 sort of result.
Can you just tell us what happened in the Leah Forster situation?
In the Leah Forster situation, during one part of her bit, I guess she just picked a random black person from the crowd and called him a goy. He was actually like a black Israeli. So that was awkward for some people, but no one in the audience named anything about it, like on Facebook, except for this one friend of mine let me know this is what happened, and like no one say anything, and I don't know what to do. And so that's where the status came from. Leah Forster responded. And just found you do better. So a realization of how words can hurt people, even if you don't intend to, which it's, you have to realize when things are slightly more racially charged than you might be aware of.
there's a part of me, you talk about your own cynicism and how you might have reacted differently, both, by the way, to your character in your book and to somebody like Yehuda Webster facing that situation with the Torah. And the sense I get is that the cynicism comes partially from just the sheer frequency in which you are subject to microaggressions, or like you said, macroaggressions of one sort or another. That's the sense I get, is that you're not describing events that happened, you know, a couple times to you in life. You're talking about the what's your background questions, the oh, you must be Ethiopian assumptions, the oh, you must have converted assumptions, all of these things that people say to Jews of color. Like, I get the sense that these are things that happen just literally as the daily rhythm of your days. And so I guess, what could we do to create a future where people might be less cynical than you, if that makes sense? Like, what would it look like to actually, as white Jews, commit to doing better, and how could we take those steps?
The base thing that needs to happen is white Jews in general acknowledge their whiteness. Now, that's not a value judgment. It's perfectly fine to be someone who's white and Jewish. And I find that's a lot of the knee-jerk, you're calling me this in this kind of way because I'm calling you that way because it's an objectively observable phenotypical fact. You're white and Jewish. If I can be black and Jewish, that means you are white and Jewish, and Asians are Asian and Jewish, and Indians are Indian and Jewish. Like, if we were in a room and someone was asked to describe the room, they wouldn't say, oh, there were three Jews there. Like, they would say, oh, it was like a black Jew and two other Jews. Or a black, well, yeah, it wouldn't even say two white Jews, it would say two other Jews, because it's not even a name, it's just the default. And to also acknowledge that, yes, you can be white and have whiteness and have white privilege and even buy into and support some tenets of white supremacy while having the same acted on upon you. The only people who get full whiteness, like full white privilege, are white Anglo-Saxon Protestant heterosexual males. LGBTQ white people, they're subject to violence, to murder, to discrimination by other, you know, white people. But they still get to enact whiteness on people who are not. Like white women, there's misogyny, there's pay discrepancies, a rape culture from other white people. But white women are still able to enact whiteness on people who are not whites, or just to have privilege of the phenotypical appearance of their whiteness. White Jews have the same thing. A Haredi-dressed white Jew, put them next to a Haredi-dressed black Jew, and there's still whiteness there. Mm-hmm. One of those can walk into any synagogue and be fine. One of them might get stopped at the door. When white Jews say that I don't have white privilege, or it's provisional, it gets taken away, that's like someone with one eye saying, I can't see, I don't have sight privilege because people with two eyes treat me a certain way. But you're speaking to people who are blind. Once that's able to be absorbed, then it'll be easier to see how those systems of whiteness are being enacted and empowered in the Ashkenormative American paradigm of Judaism. You'll be able to see how you're invoking whiteness when you're asking somebody who's Jew of color, how are you Jewish, or you don't look Jewish, because you're suspicious because they aren't white. When you ask the question or state, Jews aren't white, your question is inherently undoing its premise, because obviously Jews aren't white. But when you ask that question, you're not talking about me, you're not talking about Drake, you're not talking about Liz Cho, you're not talking about Lisa Bonet or Zoe Kravitz, you're talking about white Jews. So your question is inherently, white Jews aren't white, which is a logical fallacy in its own construction. That really needs to be dismantled and addressed and tackled for any hope of a progress to happen.
So what you're saying is that fundamentally the issue is that white Jews don't admit that they're white?
Unless it's convenient. I feel like white Jews only sort of reject whiteness in cases where they're being called whites or they're being treated as less than white by other white people.
Because otherwise, it's kind of awkward that according to the Pew Survey, 94% of American Jews identify as white. So I find it quite amazing that every single member of the 6% is on Twitter and Facebook and are very vocal.
I wanted to make sure that we got to probably, for me, the most memorable part of your book, which, I mean, I've said that I love your book, but what I loved the most was page one, was actually like before the book starts. It was this beautiful, I don't know what to call it. It was just a message to your readers, and I wanted to read it, and I'm going to read it quickly because it's a page, but it's worth reading. And then I want to hear from you why it was so important to you to put this in, and also to the extent you want to dwell on particular elements of it, that would be wonderful too. To anybody who's ever heard that they don't, quote, look Jewish, that's in quotes, look Jewish, to anybody who's ever been told they weren't ethnic enough, to the nervous Jewish parents of color and their baby boys, to those of us who converted, to those of us who didn't, to those of us with parents who don't get that they won't ever get it, to those of us with kids who don't get that they haven't gotten it yet, to anyone who's ever hated being a Jew in a room full of minorities, to anyone who's ever hated being a minority in a room full of Jews, to those of us who are proud of where we are but ashamed of where we've been, to those of us ashamed of where we are but proud of where we come from, to those of us who left, to those of us who stayed, to anyone just trying to figure it all out, here's to us, L'chaim. So that's how your book starts. And
that was pretty nice.
I want to hear why.
Again, I really want there to be an audiobook version of this.
That was one of the more tedious parts to craft, specifically because when I write and I speak, either one of two things sort of happens. There's either the assumption that whatever I'm going to write out is only applicable in, like, specifically an African-American Orthodox Jewish sort of lens, or there's someone who's a Jew of color who's upset at what I've said, and it's like, you're not the voice for me, you're not the voice of all Jews of color. That's true. I'm not the voice of all Jews of color. I am just a voice. But that doesn't mean that everything that I write is just for or to my voice. And in the book itself, there are a lot of things that I tried to touch on, like different observance upbringings, different relationship combinations, different religious backgrounds of, parents that grew up Jewish or parents that converted Jewish as an adult, but they don't understand why, like, their Jewish from birth kids, like, are having such a problem understanding something or getting it or being on this, like, Jewish bandwagon that they joined, not realizing, well, you joined as an adult, your children are being thrown into this world as a person of color as a child. That's very different. You haven't done the things yet that they are already doing. There's the gap where they don't realize that they don't know what it is to be, like, a five-year-old, let's say, Asian Jewish child, or a 10-year-old one, or an 18-year-old one, or even a 25-year-old one, because they converted to Judaism when they were 30. So they don't understand what it is to struggle with all those regular things that teenagers deal with. And then on top of that, also Jewish, in having to combine all these things in the most fraught time of your life. And then there's the other side of, maybe parents are like that and do understand that and say, no, you don't get it yet. You don't get, that this is, I want you to be better than this point that I'm at. And so I'm pushing you to surpass where I am. And so those are two dialogues that often sort of pass each other in the night. And then in general, the experiences that happen in this book happen to everybody. The people who were born here, the people who converted here, the people who like being in one space as one thing, people who hate being in one space as that thing, the people who stayed and still deal with it, and the people who left because of the experiences that happen in the story.
I'm curious whether you find the situation for Jews of color sort of better or worse in the Orthodox community. On the one hand, I could imagine a story in which it's worse because there's less connection between the Orthodox world or certain elements of the Orthodox world and the larger society, and therefore there might be sort of less excitement about diversity, et cetera, et cetera. But I can also imagine it being better because something that's much more based on acceptance of mitzvot and certain ways of behaving and conversion, you know, that there would be just an openness to anybody who has actually, you know, who actually is a Jew saying, yeah, you're one of us. So, you know, we don't have to look at it any deeper than that. So I wonder if there's a difference that you found in terms of which part of the Jewish community we're talking about.
The difference between Orthodox and non-Orthodox spaces when it comes to acceptance of race is like the difference on both sides of the Mason-Dixon line. It's still the same racism, I'll say. It's just manifest differently. When you ask, oh, so what's your story? Or what brings you here? You're still asking the same question. You're asking, what are you doing here? Mm-hmm. I don't think you belong here. Explain what you're doing here. The only difference is that in Orthodox spaces, they just flat out say it. But it's the same question you're asking.
So that raises a question for me, right? Because in a way, right, I guess I also would say that's disappointing in the sense, it's disappointing to hear, right, in the sense that you would hope that if Judaism is a vehicle for living a good life, you know, for living a life of ethics and of principle, that you would hope that in a part of the Jewish world that's more focused on Jewish commandments and Jewish ideals, that it would be better.
And, well, you could likewise say you would think it'd be better for a part of the Jewish community where the focus is on repairing the ills of the world, that it would be better.
Correct. So I guess it's equally disappointing that it's not true in both. But it does, it does sort of raise serious questions about either group sort of claiming that it's doing a good job.
I'm a big fan of saying that you're just both being equally terrible Jews. Uh-huh.
The cynicism lives. The cynicism lives.
Good. Don't let Jews ruin Judaism for you.
Yeah. That resonates for me. I've been speaking with folks lately. When I got married, my name changed from Rofus to Rofberg. We did the shmush thing, my wife and I, where you combine it. And it's caused me to think a lot about the whole framework of like a Jewish sounding name, in quotes. And that's very much related to the idea of looking Jewish, which are both fallacies, of course. And the reason I bring this up is that like, it's really hard for some people to hear that this isn't only like an Orthodox problem. It's like very difficult for some people to hear that. And the idea that this is manifesting, that racism is manifesting just as, and I'm not talking anymore about I'm talking about the issues you're talking about, but in the context of these conversations, but like for people to hear that racism really is manifesting big time in places that self-identify as progressive, as liberal, is hard. But it's something that we really got to be able to say. And more that we export our problems to other Jewish spaces, the less and less we actually address them. So I just wanted to name that. And thank you for saying what I think is true, which is that this is manifesting all over. The question I have is very different. And it's not about race.
It's time for an awkward segue.
Yes, the most awkward of segues. Your character in the book, the character that you create in your book, Ariel Samson, he becomes a congregational rabbi. And what's fascinating is he takes on this, he does like a turnaround. He takes a congregation that's struggling to have anybody in the room, and he takes a variety of steps, and before long they've grown a great deal and they have a variety of different constituencies in the room that hadn't been as excited to be there. And it connects to we talk a lot about synagogue dynamics on this show and the challenges in turning around synagogues, and even the bigger question of like whether synagogues are salvageable in certain senses in our contemporary world. So I guess I wanted to hear from you like that. It's not that it was unrelated to other pieces of the book, but it felt like a really interesting piece to have in there. And I was curious, like, do you have big thoughts or questions or theories about about synagogue turnarounds, about some of those dynamics of helping a synagogue to thrive that are part of why that thread came into your book? Because I think we'd love to hear them, and our listeners might benefit from them too if they're trying to work on their synagogues.
I think really the key to synagogue turnaround is reaching down to younger generations as opposed to trying to keep the people that are there, you know, happy. Most synagogues die because they're sort of stuck in a, you know, make this synagogue great again kind of romantic notion of, you know, what Judaism should be, what their synagogue was, and like these newfangled kids, we're not going to let them in, particularly in this new age. And by new, I want to say like last like three decades or so, with different expressions of people's sexuality, gender identity, ethnic identity, that tends to overwhelm the crowd and or generation that were the synagogue builders and the synagogue goers of like the 50s and 60s and 70s that are now dying out, which is why it's necessary to revitalize synagogues. A failure happens when there's a sort of false good faith efforts towards inclusion, whether it's inclusion of, you know, race or youth or, again, gender or sexual politics. I've been in a couple of places where, generally speaking, it's like a welcoming environment until you come around to like high holidays or something. And that's when, you know, the establishment powers that be sort of use like sermons and everything to give those, you know, punch guts to those weird different people and how they should be living and should be, you know, existing and should be Jewish. And so, You've lost that crowd now, and you've done more than lose them because you've sort of betrayed them, which kind of lured them into this, oh, we're trying to build and it's going to be space for everybody. By the way, this is how you should really be. And I'm not sure what, you know, the balance is to really pull that off. Like some places can and some do, like in Ariel's case, it was just complete luck and plot armor. So,
so, Thank you again for joining us. I mean, I can't say it enough times. This book really is something that needs to grace your bookshelf, listeners, or your Kindle, whatever version of a shelf you use. And just before we go, are there any closing thoughts, either about the book or more generally about the issues that it approaches, that you'd want to leave our listeners with as they go to whatever's next? I mean, they're listening to their podcast in their car, as they, you know, walk down the street, what should they be thinking about?
I really can't think of anything beyond read the book. Maybe not buy the book, but at least read the book. A lot of dialogue happens around, well, what should we do, or how should we, or what is that experience like? I don't know. Here's literally a textbook. Here's a social textbook of how things play out for a lot of Jews of color in both worlds. And if you want to understand what intersectionality is, this is a great example of how that works and how it fits into other spaces and weaves its way around a life. Reading how words and scenarios and situations make people feel, it's kind of self-explanatory what at least not to do.
That is the note to end on. Absolutely. Read the book. Listeners, read it. We can't recommend it highly enough. And thank you so much, Manish Tanna, for joining us for this conversation. It's been a great one, and we're really going to be reflecting back on it in the future.
It's been an amazing conversation. Thanks for having me on.
And thanks, of course, to all of you out there listening. We hope you've enjoyed this episode. We really encourage you to get Ariel Samson, Freelance Rabbi, on Amazon or at a bookstore, wherever it makes sense for you to get it, do it. We want to apologize once again for some of the little audio hiccups. We hope that you still enjoyed this episode a great deal. It's definitely one that we are going to be thinking about for a while. And we want to close out this episode, as we always do, by encouraging you to be in touch with us. And there are a wide variety of ways for you to do that. First, you can head to our Facebook page, Judaism Unbound. Second, you can go to our Twitter feed at Judaism Unbound. Third, you can go to our website, judaismunbound.com. And last but not least, you can always hit us up via email at dan@judaismunbound.com or lex@judaismunbound.com. The last request we like to make is that it's really, really deeply appreciated when you're able to give us a monetary donation. It makes a huge difference for us. And you can do that at judaismunbound.com/donate with either a monthly recurring donation or a one-time gift. So thanks so much for listening. And with that, this has been Judaism Unbound.